the headlines. Dozens of European ex-officials condemn political interference in efforts by the International Criminal Court to probe alleged Israeli war crimes against Palestinians. Indigenous groups in Canada call for a nationwide search for mass graves at residential school sites after the discovery of the remains of 215 children. And Iran says its talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal with the remaining signatories will probably not conclude in the current round. Well, welcome to Studio C in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Dozens of senior figures have condemned efforts to obstruct an investigation by the International Criminal Court into Israeli war crimes against Palestinians. In an open letter, more than 50 European ex-officials decried and called for an end to political interference in the ICC's inquiry. In the letter, they said attempts to discredit the court and block its work cannot be tolerated. Top figures expressed concern over, quote, unwarranted public criticism of the ICC's probe into Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. They also lashed out at former U.S. President Donald Trump for imposing sanctions against ICC staff members and their families, a move later reversed by Trump's successor Joe Biden. The letter is also seen as a rebuke to British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who last month criticized the ICC for investigating Israeli crimes. Lawyer and peace activist Barry Grossman says the U.S. and Israel do not accept the ICC's jurisdiction over the issue of probing Israeli crimes against Palestinians.
The United States has never submitted to the jurisdiction of the ICC, and certainly the occupation itself, otherwise known as Israel, argues, contests that it too is not really subject to the jurisdiction of the ICC. So there's no channel there on the face of it to complain about something amounting to an attempt to interfere with their processes. I think the response has to be a political one in the court of public opinion, and there can be no doubt that already for a number of years there's been no end to the threats made by both Israel and the United States to the very existence of the ICC, to individuals working on the investigation of Israeli war crimes, and so on. In fact, it was made very clear that they would be lobbying all of their allies who are subject to the jurisdiction of the ICC to withdraw funding, and that they felt, that is both Israel and the United States, that they'd be able to shut it down. And of course, it's the only real forum out there.
International pressure is mounting on Israel as pro-Palestinian rallies continue around the globe. This was especially on display when a huge anti-Israel protest took place in Washington, D.C., which surely caught the attention of U.S. lawmakers and the U.S. president himself. The Israeli regime is now seeking a permanent ceasefire with resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. How costly has the 11-day war been for Israel?
Israel's war on Gaza ended over a week ago, but voices in condemnation of the regime's crimes against the Palestinian people are still being heard around the world. Pro-Palestinian activists from across the United States descended on the capital, Washington, D.C., to hold a rally. The protesters called on Israel to stop killing Palestinians. They also called for an end to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories and demanded that the U.S. government stop funding the regime.
For us, we need to demand the following. One, immediate, unconditional lifting of the siege on Gaza. Let me repeat, immediate, unconditional lifting of the siege on Gaza, because that is what international law requires. Second, we need to hold Israel accountable in the International Criminal Court. Netanyahu is a criminal war, committed war crimes. We need to take Israel to the International Criminal Court. Third, we need the implementation of the 4 Geneva Conventions. Palestinians should be protected, not demonized.
It's definitely significant. There hasn't been a demonstration. They're not huge demonstrations. It's hundreds of people, but that's better than nothing at all. And it's not just in Washington, it's in New York, in Boston, in Michigan, Dearborn, there are, as you said, in London as well. So the the visibility is there where it wasn't before on Palestinian issues. So this is really a change. And also there's now, it's quite acceptable for Congress and Senate to put forward bills to curb the so-called aid, the military gifts of $3 billion every year for Israel to destroy Palestinians.
Other speakers rejected attempts by corporate media to use the manufactured anti-Semitism crisis to undermine public support for the Palestinian cause.
The pro-Palestine rally voiced demands that are hard to imagine for Israel to actually listen to, let alone abide by. One of them, the U.S. military aid to Israel, around $4 billion annually. Many demonstrators say that they will stand against any politician that continues to fund weapons to Israel. The demonstrators also wanted to send a clear message to the U.S. government that the days of supporting the Israeli regime without repercussions are over.
Israel's foreign minister, Gabi Ashkenazi, arrived in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, on Sunday to discuss the May 21st truce. It marked the first formal visit by an Israeli foreign minister to Egypt in 13 years. Ashkenazi had earlier said he'd discuss what he called a permanent ceasefire with Egypt's officials. The truce was brokered and is being monitored by Egypt.
Just calling for a permanent ceasefire, that's it makes you want to laugh, because a ceasefire is a break in hostilities. A permanent ceasefire would be peace. So if what they're calling for is peace, well, then now you're going to have to get into how do you come about peace. You have to negotiate. And who are you going to negotiate with? Well, you have to negotiate with Hamas, because the PA has really no authority here. So the very first thing, before anything, you have to have elections. So somehow Israel's got to allow elections to go ahead. But they won't want to do that, because that will elect Hamas. But in any case, they're going to have to deal with Hamas on the ceasefire, because Hamas is the military power, the only resistance, active resistance. The PA is basically just a caretaker for Israel.
Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing their show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, has said the fight with Israel proved that Palestinians can overcome all challenges with a strong will. Nakhala added that for every Palestinian killed by Israel, the resistance will bomb Tel Aviv. The developments over the past month have shown that the next time the regime ventures an offensive against Gaza, it would face grave consequences.
Indigenous groups in Canada are demanding a nationwide search for mass graves at former residential school sites. The group said that the government should also help research undocumented deaths and burials at the sites. Last week, a mass grave containing remains of 215 children was found at a former residential school in the state of British Columbia. The bodies belonged to students, some as young as three. Canada forcibly sent more than 150,000 Indigenous children to residential schools between 1831 and 1996. A 2015 investigation documented abuse, malnutrition, and rape at the schools. The Pope called the system a cultural genocide for forcing kids to abandon their native language and to convert to Christianity. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has called the system a shameful reality of his country. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says the 2015 probe was quite right, called the assimilation system for Indigenous kids in Canada a cultural genocide.
There are reports that maybe as much as 25% of the kids that were brought into the residential school system actually died. So there is, unfortunately, probably many more burial sites on residential schools that exist in Canada, and maybe even burial sites that aren't on residential schools. But, you know, the practice was in prisons and places like these residential schools that they would bury, you know, children or people often in unmarked graves on the site. Actually, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission documented 3,100 missing children. There's been 900 more identified, and there are probably even thousands more when you look around the country and looking at the schools in Western Canada, Northern Ontario, and Northern Quebec, where there still is a large Indigenous population. But we attempted to assimilate them basically out of existence, and that's correct to term that as a form of cultural genocide. The federal Liberal government has promised to investigate the sites and put forward the money for this ground-penetrating radar so they can identify a lot of these children, hopefully bring closure to the families. But we destroyed the social and cultural basis for a lot of the natives, and we substituted, you know, alcohol, drugs, social welfare, and, you know, sniffing gasoline.
Colombian demonstrators have once again clashed with security forces as the country undergoes a second month of anti-government protests. Police fired tear gas at protesters in Facatativa, a municipality near the capital, Bogota. Clashes erupted while protesters were attending the funeral of an indigenous man who was reportedly killed during a previous demonstration. Anger is growing against the social and economic policies of the government of President Iván Duque. The demonstrations began in April over a proposed tax increase. The government later withdrew the plan, but the protests grew wider against police violence, poverty, and health crisis. Dozens of people have been killed since then. The UN has called for an independent probe into the deadly unrest in the South American country. Iran says the talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal aimed at reviving the accord will probably not conclude in the current round. Iran's top negotiator described the talks as complicated, adding that negotiations have reached the main issues of dispute. Abbas Araghchi noted that progress has been made in the talks, but delegations might need to return to their capitals for consultations. The current round of talks on the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA, had previously been hailed as the final round. Tehran says it will return to compliance with the accord after verifiable removal of all sanctions the U.S. has imposed on the country since pulling out of the deal in 2018. Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says the latest report by the U.N. nuclear watchdog confirms Tehran's move to limit the agency's monitoring of its nuclear work. Qasem Gharibabadi said the report shows the agency has not been able to monitor Iran's nuclear work beyond its safeguards agreements with Tehran under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Gharibabadi added that the IAEA's report on Iran's enriched uranium stockpile is merely based on an assessment. Iran's decision to limit the agency's monitoring activities followed the December parliamentary law that asked the government to withdraw from the additional protocol and scale back nuclear-related commitments. That is in response to the U.S. pullout of the 2015 nuclear deal and its anti-Iran sanctions. The IAEA report has estimated that Tehran's enriched uranium stockpile is around 16 times the limit laid out in the nuclear deal. The correspondent in Vienna, Homolesky, says the latest IAEA report to its board of governors shows the impact of the agency's complementary access to Iranian nuclear sites being restricted.
The Iranian ambassador to the agency, Mr. Qasem Gharibabadi, and he said that the information given in this report, first of all, you mentioned there the stockpile of Iran's enriched uranium. Based on the media reports we're getting, the number being mentioned around 3,241 kilograms, which of course is way more than the limit that was set in the JCPOA, is, according to Iran, and also acknowledged by the agency, is just an estimate. Because, as you said, because of this law that was passed by the Iranian parliament, the IAEA has had restricted access. And what Mr. Gharibabadi is saying in his response is that the level of access that the agency currently has is only based on the comprehensive safeguards agreement that Iran has with the agency, and it doesn't go beyond that. So any access that the agency had to Iran when it came to verifying and monitoring Iran's implementation of the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement and the restrictions set under that, and any access that the agency has had based on the voluntary transparency measures that Iran was implementing, including complementary access given under the additional protocol or other accesses and other information that Iran provided to the agency based on other voluntary and transparency measures that it signed up to under the JCPOA, have now been halted.
Campaigning for Iran's 13th presidential election is gaining momentum as the candidates appear on TV and radio to present their plans to the people. Our correspondent Humen Abedi has the latest.
IRIB, the broadcasting organization of Iran, the red carpet treatment is being given to the candidates who want to contest in 13th presidential election. Several studios are hosting the seven runners who explain in detail their plans.
The economy under my administration will focus on domestic production and exports. Whatever creates obstacles on that path has to be removed, and whatever strengthens that sector must be paid attention to and boosted. One of my administration's approaches will be to use a strong foreign policy to create international markets to improve our domestic production and exports. We can make the best of the demands in countries in South America, Africa, and South Asia to achieve that end.
Zakani stressed that the next administration has to change course and rely on Iran's domestic capabilities and utilize all regional and international capacities to move towards success. The other candidate, Saeed Jalili, said Iran must not await favors from those who murdered Iranian anti-terror commander Qasem Soleimani. He also added that a wrong approach and a weak performance cannot take the country to the summits. Mohsen Rezaei also took the floor to talk to the people regarding his economic agenda.
Some people misunderstood my plans about boosting the national currency. I said we can increase the value of our currency to become the third strongest money in the region after the US dollar and euro. It means that when you go to the exchange market after the first two, Iran's rial would be exchanged the most.
Rezaei also called for reforms in Iran's insurance, banking, and stock market systems. Reformist Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who was speaking at a news network, said that the main problems of the country today are due to macro policies, and the world-known scientific models should be used to solve the problems. In the end, Mehralizadeh referred to economic problems of people, but asked them to go to the polls to use the right of democracy to solve such issues. Some 60 million Iranians are eligible to vote in the 13th presidential election, which is slated to be held on June 18th. Human Abedi, Tehran.
And that is World News. Bye bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're going to be discussing Warriors from the North, directed by Naseeb Farah and Sorenstein Jespersen. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Masood Shajareh, who is the Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Now, Warriors from the North is a complex and multi-layered narrative that gives you a chilling insight into what fuels the current trend of Western Muslim youth leaving the West to join radical extremist groups abroad, such as Al-Shabaab, which is an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group in Somalia. The documentary tells the story of a Danish-Somalian boy in Copenhagen who fell victim to Al-Shabaab recruiters.
We were young men in our early 20s. We missed action. I was very attracted by being able to do something and stop being just one of them who's looked down on, you know. And now Mohammed's in Somalia. He's a warrior for Al-Shabaab. His father, Abukar, is afraid that his son will also become a suicide bomber.
I joined Al-Shabaab because I had nothing else to do or nothing left for it. But to drink.
We were a true group. We felt that Al-Shabaab showed us respect. I'd never experienced respect like that before.
And first of all, welcome both of you to the show. And Rich, as our guest film critic, what was your take on Warriors from the North?
Well, it's really, really well made, and it's got that kind of Danish filmmaking sheen to it. Beautifully shot, very clever use of archival footage and stills, and I mean, they make a lot of use of videotape that they get of these warriors, kind of
so-called
really
warriors.
Chilling, yeah. Really chilling videotapes. And but then there's also a lot of footage shot in Copenhagen that's very beautifully shot, very cleverly put together. It's only an hour long. It's a short documentary, so it's not really a kind of comprehensive look at the situation. It's a very specific story about these specific people and in their situation, even though it does have references to the larger story.
And for our viewers who haven't seen the film, in a nutshell, could you just briefly describe what it's about?
Basically, it centers on this man who calls himself the Shadow because he doesn't want to be identified. So you only see him as a shadow on screen, just his silhouette. And he tells his story about being a disaffected youth, basically had a bad breakup and tries to recover by partying and getting drunk. And of course, his family doesn't approve of that, so he doesn't really have his family around him. And he's on his own, and he makes all these friends who take him into this closed circle and kind of groom him to go to Somalia, which is where he's from originally, but he hasn't been back there since he was a child. Mm-hmm. And he tells the story quite coherently. You understand why he fell into this group. He loves the camaraderie of these other men, and then that group dissolved. But some of the men went to Somalia.
And we'll actually touch more on that.
And that's where the film veers. It follows one of his friends, who has disappeared in Somalia, and the friend's father is trying to find him there. So you get that parallel story of the father trying to find his son.
It's pretty much, essentially, that's what happens. We don't want to give too much away, but Masood, I'd like your take on the documentary. As someone who works on tackling Islamophobia, did you have the same take as Rich?
No, I think the film didn't go out to be Islamophobic. I mean, I actually think it was quite clear that. But I think the environment and the way that the whole thing is within our society, it really came out that way because, you know, I, as the film was about the franchise sort of youth getting involved and doing something which is unsavory, you know, say the least. But that happens to a lot of our youth, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And it really didn't tackle that, you know, that aspect. It sort of, what it sort of tackled is that here, Islam, you know, it's give the perception that here was an Islam violent sort of thing, an output for them to go and do this. And, you know, the shots, for example, sort of having discussion in the mosque or having sort of discussion outside the shop with Arabic writing in the back and so forth, it really created that association. Mm-hmm. While in reality, the other side of the story was saying, really, this is not the case. This is just a bunch of youth who are really lost.
You know? So you're saying there's multiple messages in this film?
It is, but I think that message was mixed up with some other messages which were sort of visual messages and which is conflicting one another.
Well, that's a really good point, and I'd like to take a brief break now from the discussion. Rich, what did you make of this story and his struggle to bring back his son?
It's quite a wrenching story because he's really worried about his son. He knows that the life of one of these kids who goes to Somalia tends to last about 1 or 2 years before they're involved in some sort of bombing, which is just horrible to think about, for a father to think about his son being taken off there. He doesn't understand why his son even fell into this group. It's pretty wrenching. It's very intense. And also, the Shadow, the other character, who was a good friend of Muhammad, is talking about his friend who's just gone, and he doesn't know what's happened to him.
And I think one of the interesting points about this father figure, who probably represents the voice of all the parents struggling to bring back their children who are lost to extremist groups, is that the father is nothing like his son. And I think many people might just be surprised to see that usually the idea is that the children become radicalized by their parents. But this isn't the case, is it, Masood?
No, I think this is what where I think the documentary failed. Although it was giving messages that strengthened that, but it failed to actually say that, you know, this conveyor belt sort of that is sort of usually talked by British government and other governments, that, you know, people start one side and then eventually they become radicalized at the end, which is being disputed by all academics and indeed by intelligence services, but it still is being pushed as a basis of our anti-terrorism sort of strategy. It's not factual, it's actually false. And, you know, this guy, if anything, was quite a misguided group of people, very alienated, all of them. And out of boredom and alienation of where they were actually dragged into that arena. And this was, it was a fact, but wasn't really strengthened.
But this documentary is about the personal stories of the individuals, not so much addressing the politics of the situation.
No, but you see, it's very difficult not to, you know, because at the end of the day, that is what makes this very moving. And you know, for example, many of other youth in our society, they might not be Muslim, they might go and join a gang, and they actually end up going as much wrong as these guys gone. And that is something...
Or they get into a right-wing group that commits atrocities at home.
I mean, this is, you know, is a really a challenge for our society to, first of all, to understand this phenomenon and then to address it, if possible. And this is sort of... did not actually reach that. Look, these youth, although they got involved in this thing, but they were no different to other youth in the society who gets misguided and out of boredom and have nothing to do, and of the fact that, you know, I mean, they were saying that was a group of them coming together, it was a family for them. So there was something really lacking in the society.
Rich, would you agree with Masood, what he's saying there, that this documentary should have given more context to what's happening?
I mean, I think since it's just a one-hour documentary, it's very short, and I think they were specifically trying to tell this one story. But they do bring in stories from other people. They have the one, there's the extensive video clips of the boy who went from the UK to Somalia, and then he got out of Al-Shabaab. And I wish they had replaced that story with another story of someone in Denmark who found the family in his mosque and didn't, you know, and found what he was missing, you know. And I thought that was what was missing in the film, was the story of someone who found the positive side of Islam, the peaceful side, and, you know, and didn't succumb to violence, which isn't really part of Islam.
Well,
and the film does make that clear. It makes it clear that this violence and these kind of, you know, bombers are not actually Islamic. That's not part of Islam.
I think that's a really important point, that you make that point. And I'm afraid we'll just have to pause it just for now.
Look at the vulnerable young teenagers who have problems with their families, who have problems with the government, who have issues with police, who are an easy target for Al-Shabaab, because the person's mind is already crafted and believed, you know, in his own mind. He doesn't trust the police, but the police are the ones that are locking him up and putting him in jail. He doesn't really trust his family because his family doesn't give him enough support. So what does he do? He becomes fooled, like me. He joins Al-Shabaab, ends up being killed himself.
You really get a sense of how alienated and isolated these young Somalis feel in Denmark. Rich, do you think this documentary was successful in outlining the reasons why these young Danish Somalis go and fight for Al-Shabaab?
It kind of hints at the situation in Europe, where young Somali teenagers are treated like outsiders, so they don't feel like they belong in the society where they've grown up. And these young men have grown up in Denmark, but they don't feel Danish. And they don't really feel Somalian either, because they never lived there, really. So they feel like they don't have any home. And it does really convey that idea. I don't know what's the answer to that. We need to have more open societies that accept people. And maybe the trick is to target prejudice and these ideas that the general public have that marginalize groups of people. But that happens on every level of society, not just ethnically and
Yeah, no, of course. I saw you nodding your head there, Masood. Would you agree with what Rich just said?
Yes, I think, I mean, our society is much more complicated than one issue results in one thing. You know, it's not as simple as that. Alienation is one aspect. And the other aspect is that these are the youth who, some of them came across the way that they were being interviewed. They were concerned about injustices around the world. And they wanted to do something about it, which is a very amicable thing to feeling to have. But instead of that feeling being strengthened and supported in the right way of addressing those things, the only thing they could find was actually going and being recruited by these guys. And that is actually a failure that I see in our society day in, day out. And indeed, the government policies and so forth exaggerate this. And the reality is that there are forcing us not to be political, not to address these issues, not to talk, the elephant in the room is being ignored. And the reality is that these youth, and indeed the other youth, are not given the right tools to be, activists in the real sense for the right thing, for the right reason, and with the right tools. And if you remove that from any youth, you're actually leaving open very negative aspect to sneak in, because youth want to do something. They want to be part of a solution. And I think we're failing them in that way. And the other aspect is that we are giving wrong messages as a society. We actually tell, through our policies overseas and things, we're actually giving message that end justifies the means. And that message ultimately is a terrorist justification. And if we give that message could be interpreted and used in other arenas, and people go towards these sort of extreme ways of addressing something which is very, very noble.
And Rich, I get the sense from this documentary that the filmmakers are trying to, while not necessarily directly sympathize with the recruits, but and at the same time they're condemning and showing how horrific their crimes are. Are you getting that sense that the recruits are victims in their own right as well?
Yeah, the film clearly presents them as victims. It presents them as good children who have been brainwashed and kind of convinced that this is the way that they should act and mm-hmm. what they should do. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a sense that it's presenting them as it's not their fault. They're 16-year-old who have been convinced that what they're doing is the right thing to do, and it does. I mean, our discussion is going way beyond the material in the film, because it is a short film and it is very concentrated on this very specific
story. And that's a merit to the film, because it raises many serious questions.
It causes you to think about these things that it doesn't really address, and that's quite important.
And we're going to talk about sort of the vulnerability issue of these recruits.
At one time, I was very seductive to doing this thing. I sort of believed in it for a moment, and I was really at one time in my life.
I used to think that killing is okay, that, wrapping yourself up with suicide bomb and exploding yourself in the midst of 10,000 people or something was okay. Until I got to a certain level, and I saw that it was wrong. Endless, non-stop killing for no reason. When I saw more civilians dying than actual soldiers here in Somalia, that's when I stopped being Ashraf. I wish there's something I can do to stop from all these other kids from getting fooled by the same way I got fooled, being tricked into just endless killing. I want to change.
So it's Mohammed Ali Omar there in that clip, and he's in hiding in Somalia but wishes to return to Europe. And Rich, are there many options for people like him if they wish to return? Because I think he fears of being prosecuted.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the legal situation for someone like that is. I don't know if he would be. I don't know what he's done. Has he
but
done
in the film,
anything
does it,
illegal?
Does it show that path at all?
Yeah, and the film doesn't really go into that. I found myself wishing that was a separate documentary about him, because I think his story is quite interesting and it's more hopeful because it does have it's not finished yet because he is in hiding, but it's a fascinating story to me, and I think, I'm hoping some documentary filmmaker watches this and thinks, and goes and finds him and tells his story
and maybe helps him
reintegrate into European society.
Mm-hmm. And Masood, following from that clip, How is it that young people, I mean, you talked about it earlier, how this film doesn't explain why they're being tricked or how. Could you help explain why and how they're being tricked into mosques and joining in extremist groups?
Well, really, it's difficult to say exactly how it's happening, but as I said, there are a number of issues.
Is it that they're taking a literalist interpretation of Islam, perhaps Wahhabism?
Well, what we know that, and this film touches on that, that actually the most ignorant of Islam youth are the ones who actually get recruited. One recruit from Britain, he actually ordered Islam for Dummies, you know, just before going. So this is not something that is motivated by Islam, but unfortunately our way of combating it is all geared towards we got to find out this Islam and change it. And unfortunately one thing which I really felt it was wrong in the film, it gives two alternatives, one for the youth to go and be a terrorist, and the other one was actually going to club. And the third option wasn't there. I mean, you didn't look at hundreds and thousands of youth who are Muslim, who are practicing Muslim, who are great contributors. And this stereotyping, unfortunately, is very damaging. I think also the reality is that, you know, on one side, the end justifies mean policy, which West has been pursuing, is the problem. And the other thing is actually, we have got involved from the West with the Saudi regime in creating a new version of Islam for our political sort of needs in the Middle East region. And this has had backfired. It backfired in Afghanistan, it's backfiring now, it's backfiring in Syria. And out of that it actually comes these sort of horrifying ideology of killing everyone, and which it's now interpreted that these are Muslims killing non-Muslims, but the reality is that groups like Daesh are killing more Muslims than non-Muslim, but they're killing everyone and justifying it by Islam, which is which was social engineered as a foreign policy with the help of our Saudi partners.
Well, that's definitely way outside of the film, but thank you for the explanation. But I think the filmmakers in this documentary are saying it's easy to write off these groups of people, but I think they want to make viewers think that what role do the West play in radicalizing these individuals? Is that one of the messages?
I think so, yeah. I think there is that message about why are these kids just left to fall through the cracks of the society? Why is their only option to either become radicalized or go out clubbing and getting drunk? Why are they left like that? It doesn't really examine that. It kind of raises the issue to think about, and I kind of wish it had. But then, that's another film. So.
Mm-hmm. And final thought for 30 seconds to you, Masood. Would you recommend that people see this film? I know it's only an hour long, and it raises many questions. But as a starting point, perhaps.
I do, but I say again, you know, some of the visuals conflicted with the messages it was given. So you know, different people could watch it and come up with different things. I could imagine very clearly some Islamophobes and extreme right will see it, and it will be justification for all their visions.
So it's open to interpretation,
sure,
I guess.
I'm not sure about that. It does come out fairly strongly about how
does.
Immoral the actions of these suicide bombings are.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there, but we could keep talking all day. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks for tuning in. I've been Camila Shambiati.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in
repeated lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the issues that parents may face during the upbringing of their children. We're discussing teenagers with our dear and beloved Sheikh Masumi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Masumi. Thank you very much for being with us.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's my honor to be here with you.
Thank you. So, Sheikh Masumi, we're talking about the youth and how they're soft-hearted. And we said one of the consequences of this soft-heartedness is that they are very receptive to the truth. Can you please explain this to us, how they are receptive to the truth?
As you mentioned, this teenage age where usually they become a little bit rude, as I said so many times. And we think usually that they are very disobedient. They don't want to. They don't want the truth. They don't want the guidance. But according to Hadith and Quran, it is totally wrong. They are always looking for the truth, the right things and the righteous. Let me give a small hadith. It is from Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, our sixth imam. One of his companions, he was the representative of Imam in Basra, the city of Basra of Iraq. So once he came to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam asked him, "O Abu Ja'far, how did you find the people of Basra? Did they accept whatever you say? Did they accept our guidelines, our guidance?" Then he said to Imam, "No, unfortunately, no. Very few people are listening to your, you know, hadith and listening to the guidance." Then Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "Alayka bil ahdath, fa innahum asra'u ila kulli khair." Specifically, Imam alayhi salam told him, advised him to mingle with the teenagers and young people, because Imam Sadiq alayhi salam knows everything, yeah? So he said, don't go, you know, behind these old and adult people, because they are not very easygoing with you. They don't accept very easily. But you always try your best to guide the young people, teenagers especially, because, as I said, they are very soft-hearted. They are always looking for the right things. So, alayka bil ahdath. Ahdath means the new generation, the young people, youngsters. Because Imam knows their heart is empty, they have very soft heart, and they are looking for right things. That's why you can see, inshallah, we will, in our next time after the break, we will discuss, we will give some more examples of this.
Of targeting the teenagers. But we're very worried about wrong people targeting teenagers. So I guess we should hurry and rush to get there before anyone else.
Definitely.
Okay, let's take an early break and then we'll be back to further this discussion. Don't go away.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Sheikh Masumi. We're talking about how the young are very receptive to the truth. And even Imam Sadiq advised his representative to target the youth and use them as his audience. How can we follow that advice in our day and time?
You mentioned a very important point, that we should hurry, because our teenagers, they have an empty heart. So they are ready to get whatever guidelines you are giving, whatever information you are giving. So before your enemy approaches them, you should approach them. And you should give them the right guidelines so they can spend their rest of life according to that. So when we see the life of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam in the city of Medina, you know, always, you know, mostly the young generation, youngsters, they were the first people to follow the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. Likewise, in other societies also, look at the revolution of Iran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You know better than me that most of the people who were, you know, saying labbaik to the call of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala alayh, were young people, youngsters. And in this, the holy war, 8 years war between Iran and Iraq, you can see a lot of young, very teenagers even, they were the upfront, in the front line of the, you know, battlefield. So what we can understand from these examples, that our teenagers, they are always ready to listen to you, but with one condition. We have to understand them first, and after understanding them, by applying and utilizing the golden rulings of Islam and Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, after this, if we give them the guidelines, definitely it will help them. They will follow your guidelines, and it will help them keep themselves away from the, you know, satanic or the our enemies guidelines.
What are these golden rules?
Again,
we begin with respect, since childhood.
Since childhood, respect. And confidence, giving them confidence. Building their, you know, confidences are very important. And giving them love, respect and love. They are always thirsty of love. Like if someone is very thirsty, what do you do? What, you give him water, yeah? Water quenches his thirst. But if you don't give water, you give some juices or some any other liquid, it may not quench his thirst. So he will look for water after he leaves from here. He will go somewhere else and look for the water. Likewise, our teenagers, they are thirsty of love. If you give them enough love at home, they will not look for love, you know, in the streets, you know, in the society. So this is another very important rule.
Okay. We're going to have to cut you short there for the break, but we'll cover more rules after the break, inshallah. Don't go away.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the golden rules that will help our children become more receptive of the truth. So we said respect, we said love, we said feed them with confidence sufficiently. What else should parents consider?
You provide a very good environment at home and good friends for him and befriend with him. So these are very, very important rules. If they get enough of these things, the dose of these things at home, definitely they will not look for it outside the home, and it will help you guiding them easily towards the right path. And in this teenage, they, as our topic is, they are looking for the right thing, yeah, in this teenage. That's why we say, when we see that when you face a teenager, when you ask him, what do you want to become in future? Usually he says that I want to become a doctor to help the patients and the people, yeah. Or he says, I want to become a firefighter to help the people. So these things show that he likes the right and good things. He hates the bad things and bad qualities. So this is a natural thing in teenagers, which shows again that they have soft heart. So again, it is our parents' duty to provide them with their needs according to this soft heart. So we have to polish this beautiful quality and provide them the necessary things so they can use this soft heart. And we should not feed them with things which lead in having a hard heart.
So when we're dealing with teenagers, if we want to respect them and give them confidence, we shouldn't treat them like they're kids, right?
Yeah.
But they're not adults either.
Either.
What do we do here?
So definitely, as Islam said, they are wazir.
Advisors?
Yeah, advisors, yeah. So how do you treat an advisor, you know? So there are some beautiful ahadith also which mention that if you want to make a decision regarding your anything, your about your life, about your home, about your any other thing, hadith say, first you take advice of your teenager, your youngsters.
Mm-hmm. So that's one way to give them confidence.
Because they have a very sharp mind.
But you know,
very intellectual brain also they have. So
but
they're
very inexperienced, so they probably come up with not very smart answers.
Again,
and if you're not, and if you're defying that, you're actually hurting their confidence.
Imam knows about these things. That's why the Imam says, first you go take his suggestion, then that suggestion you give to the old people, you know, the experienced people. So the mixture of their experience and youngsters' sharp mind.
That's good for us, but what does it do to the honor and respect, the confidence of the child when they continually see their advice being, not used?
It's not like this. Sometimes their advice is, you know, a lot of people, they use their advices. Uh-huh. I have seen also in my life, there are a lot of parents, fathers, they, you know, take advice of their young children, and sometimes they give very good advice also.
All right.
Suggestions.
Thank you very much. That's all the time that we have, unfortunately. If you missed the program, don't worry. You can always download an archive from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com, click on Call of Islam Radio. You'll see Islamic Upbringing there with all its programs. You can also find us on social media platforms. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Telegram, and YouTube. Simply search Call of Islam Radio as well. Or you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.